Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
I knew that what we've achieved, what we thought was impossible, was reality. I knew that we shared the energy that fuels Boston's fire when we presented our city's case to the United States Olympic Committee. And I knew that Boston was destined to be America's bid to host the 2024 Games.
Well, maybe not so destined after all. That's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh back in January after the U.S. Olympic Committee announced that Boston would be America's pick to compete for the 2024 Summer Games. Boston dropped its bid yesterday after public support for the bid evaporated. Now, Los Angeles could become the designated American city. L.A. hosted the Summer Games back in 1932 and again in 1984, and both times the city made money. But not everyone is so sure that could happen a third time, or whether hosting the Games would be worth some of the possible headaches. For more on this, we're joined by Jack Humphreyville. He's a member of the Greater Wilshire Neighborhood Council, and he writes the LA Watchdog column for City Watch. Welcome to you, Jack.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm great. And we're also joined by Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Gizmodo. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's begin with you because you're a big booster of this idea. And give me your one-line reason why LA should host the Games.
LA has proven to be a leader in Olympic game hosting. And we could not only inspire the city and the world, but we can also help turn the Olympics around as an event that other cities will want to host as well.
Okay. And Jack, you're a little more skeptical.
Just a touch.
And why is that?
Well, you know, I actually agree with Alyssa. I think it'd be fantastic that, you know, if we could host another Olympics. 1984 was probably the best example of any Olympics that's ever been held. But, you know, my questions get into at what cost and who pays. And the other thing is how are we going to compete against, let's say, Germany, France, and Italy, who have the state governments that are going to support them, when our city government doesn't even have enough money to fix potholes. So how much is it going to cost and who pays? And I don't think the city should be on the hook.
And Alyssa, I guess your argument is that we already have the facilities, largely.
I think that's the biggest argument in our favor, is that a lot of these other places that want to host their proposals come with the little caveat that, oh, yes, and we have to build this gigantic stadium and get everyone on the right page. We have all the facilities we need. They're all ready to go. And they're being used this week during the Special Olympics, which are being held at a very large event right now.
Right. So, and how's that turning out?
It's so far so good, as far as I've heard.
Right. So what about traffic? Because back in 1984, there were a lot fewer people here. People back then were worried about the traffic, and it didn't materialize. But, you know, things are different now. The infrastructure is you know, worse off when it comes to the actual physical state of the roads and freeways. And so is that a big concern for you, Alyssa?
For me, in addition to being an Olympics booster, I'm also a transit booster. So I believe that a lot of the big rail infrastructure projects that we're working on right now will be finished by that time. They're supposed to be. We're having the Red Line, you know, go all the way to UCLA. We have the Expo Line, which will definitely be done next year. We have some other big transit improvements, including hopefully a connection to LAX via People Mover that will connect to light rail. So I think that this will not only definitely happen by 2024, but also that the games happening will spur them to happen faster.
Okay. So it'll be good for public transit. Jack, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, in 1984, it was fantastic because nobody was on the roads. I mean, people in L.A. knew that there was going to be a problem, and they stayed off the roads. Quite frankly, the 84 Olympics were a disaster area as far as the tourism industry was concerned, because everybody was afraid of the traffic, and yet, you know, it was probably the easiest time to move around. If Angelenos know that there's going to be a traffic jam, they're going to figure it out, and they're going to avoid the problem like the plague. And if an involves, you know, sort of a civic duty to make sure everybody can get to, you know, the various venues, which will probably, a number of which will not be, you know, accessible by mass transit. Either one, it's not designed that way, and two, it won't be ready on time. But, you know, they'll go out of their way to, you know, play ball and make sure everything works. That's what we did in 1984. That's what we do now when Obama comes to town. You know, we you know, people will adapt. But, you know, I think the other issue that we have that nobody's talked really about is what's going to be the impact on the tourist business. And in 84, the hotel that I was staying at was vacant. I mean, there just wasn't anybody there.
Hmm. Yeah. And in Britain, I understand that there were fewer tourists during the Olympics there in London. And Alyssa, I guess there is the question of opportunity costs. Like, what would happen if what do we lose if the Olympics weren't there in the first place? I guess you can't really address that. But do you think about that?
I think that any advantage that we could get from the city, or any advantage that we can get for LA, is outweighing any of these worries. We also have to think about it that this is 10 years down the line. A lot of the technology that we are, you know, kind of shuffling around and worrying about right now, things like mass transit, are going to change significantly, including the way we handle things like broadcast rights, including the way that we do sports marketing campaign. So a lot of this is going to change, and we can be the leader, as we have before, in how these large scale events are being held in a sustainable and an efficient way.
Right. And you note also that we are still making money off the 84 Olympics.
That's true. I mean, that's the great and amazing thing about LA 84 that a lot of people don't know about, that we had a foundation set up that's still providing these incredible opportunities in sports to children all over the city.
Yeah, you know, in terms of just, I don't disagree with anything that, you know, this will be a great thing. I mean, LA 84, the charitable foundation that was set up, is, I think, distributed a couple hundred million dollars. But one of the big things that associated with the 84 Olympics was Proposition N, which was passed in 1978, which basically said that the city was not going to backstop the Olympics, and that came after the Montreal event. You know, I don't know what the media rights will be worth. I don't know how much the costs will be for, you know, to set up the Olympics. Andrew Zimbalist, who's the, you know, well-known professor who has done a lot of work on it, these international types of events, said it would cost us cost Boston $15 billion, but only $4 billion of that was for the venues. So if we go from $15 billion, let's say we can do it for free and get down to 11, there's still a $6 or $7 billion shortfall. And so where is that money going to come from? You know, we have tickets. You know, Zimbalist thought the ticket sales would be $1 billion, media rights would be $3 or $4 billion, and or $2 or $3 billion or something. Corporate sponsorships would be a whole bunch of money, and licensing. But there's still a huge, massive shortfall here. And my question is who's going to be responsible for it?
Well, what would that money be spent on, that $6 to $7 billion?
Well, in Zimbalist's piece that he had in Harvard Magazine, which is sort of my source, is operations would have been, just to operate it would have been about $5 billion. To fix up the venues would have been $4 billion. The infrastructure was going to be $4 billion. Security was going to be $1 billion, and cost overruns would probably be another $1 billion. Miscellaneous costs would be another $1 billion. So, you know, there's some real money here that we're talking about. And, you know, where does the shortfall come from? I mean, the people in Boston, you know, I mean, I come from back east. I went to school in Boston for 15 years, for crying out loud. And those people, you know, pretty sensible people, and they just weren't going to put up with a $10 billion loss. I don't think the city or the county should put up with a $10 billion loss. I don't think we should put up with a $5 billion loss.
And Alyssa, is there a point there that, you know, these games are, what, 10 years out, plus or minus, and that the politicians making the decisions today, the mayor is for it, he says, are not going to be around then?
Well, hopefully they're still alive. Hopefully we all are, and we haven't been,
well, in their current offices, let's say.
Hopefully we'll still be here. But I think, the interesting thing about the 1984 Olympics was that the lead time was very short back then. You know, you only found out and had to kind of launch into action. You didn't have much time to think about what was going on. You kind of had to just problem solve. And one of the great things that we can, precedents that we can look at from the 84 Olympics was the way that the city used design to change the way that the city address the games and the way that the infrastructure was built to make it feel like this beautiful, cohesive, wonderful way of experiencing the Olympics, both in person and on TV, with very little money and with very ephemeral light to the ground solutions. These two amazing designers, Deborah Sussman and John Jurdy, who sadly are no longer with us as of this year, they set a precedent where they were able to solve really great problems very intelligently using design and saving a ton of money for the city. So I definitely think we can do it if we look to that inspiration.
You know, I would say, you know, all that's true for argument's sake. I think we need some protections, you know, from the termed out politicians who will promise us anything, that, you know, the city and the county are not going to be on the hook for billions. And like we did in like we did in 1978, we passed a charter amendment, which did not survive, by the way, with the new charter, passed a charter amendment saying that, you know, the city and the county are not going to be on the hook for all these cost overruns.
OK, we'll leave it there. I'm sure we'll be debating this issue in the years to come, because the final decision won't be made for a couple of years, until 2017. I want to thank you both very much.
Thank you.
L-A-L-A-L-A.
Jack Humphreyville writes the LA Watchdog column for City Watch. Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Gizmodo. Press players, we want to hear from you. Do you want the Olympics to come to Los Angeles? Yay or nay? Let us know. You can reach out at 1-844-PRESSPLAY and also on Twitter and Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why it may be end times for the once powerful studio Relativity Media. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Relativity Media is the biggest Hollywood studio you've probably never heard of. It's made and distributed a lot of movies and TV in the past decade, but there have not been many hits. And yet, Relativity managed to raise a lot of money. Many in Hollywood whispered that the company CEO, the charismatic Ryan Kavanaugh, was operating a sophisticated, high-stakes shell game. Well, now it's gone beyond whispers. Relativity is facing several lawsuits, and the company could be facing bankruptcy soon. Kim Masters is here now. She's editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of The Business, heard on Mondays at 2:30 right here on KCRW. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, Relativity, if we haven't heard that name, tell us briefly what it is.
It's made a lot of TV shows and movies that you may not even remember. I mean, I think their biggest hits was a sword and sandals thing called Immortals, and then they had a thing called Limitless, which was notable because Bradley Cooper kind of became a big deal, and he was in it. And other than that, it's, you know, Ryan Kavanaugh had this story that he was going to use some kind of algorithm, you know, and he was going to figure out a foolproof way to make mid-budget hits. Mm-hmm. And shockingly, Madeline, it was not foolproof because
As many have found out before him. Yes.
Yes. Well, but he talked a good game. Yeah.
Well, tell us about him and where did he come from? Because apparently he wasn't in the movie business before.
No, he was a local boy. He's been in the movie business for quite some time now. He started out, he had another investment company that fell into difficulty in the past. But for some years, he started out doing what they call slate deals, you know, getting investors to put money into films mm-hmm. that maybe, say, Universal Studios, Universal Pictures made. And, you know, when you're kissed into a studio film, your chances of success may be somewhat better because the studio isn't using that foolproof algorithm, but possibly, you know, some experience and maybe they have some people in marketing and they know what they're doing. But it's, you know, that he morphed from that into trying to launch this film company. And for years, he's been able to keep this thing going. You know, he's had investors. There was a big hedge fund named Elliott, and they split on, I believe, rather bad terms. And then Ron Burkle, a name you might have heard.
The supermarket guy.
Supermarket uh-huh. magnate. He invested and is still an investor and is keeping very mum, as it seems that, you know, the big final, you know, the people are always hesitant. They say, Ryan Kavanaugh, you know, he could always pull another rabbit out of the hat because he's pulled a lot of rabbits have come out of that hat. But this time it seems maybe the actual final rabbit is out of the hat already, and there is no other rabbit.
And is that because no one wants to give him any more money?
No one appears to want to give him any more money. And he keeps kind of announcing one thing, you know, I found this investor that's going to, it's going to give us money. And every time, of course, if they give them the money, the terms would be worse and worse. It's kind of like borrowing when your credit's not so good and the interest rates get rather high. But the end of the story seems to be that there is no actual money and that the bankruptcy may be kind of imminent. We think there's a pretty substantial layoff about to take place. They have some 300 and some employees. I heard 90. They're saying closer to 50, I think. But whatever it is, they're rearranging the deck chairs, I think, at this point, is the consensus in Hollywood.
And so what is this going to mean in terms of FOB? Because as you said earlier, there have been many failures in the past and high-profile failures. And so is he just the latest in a long line of people who haven't made it in Hollywood?
You know, there's always a company in Hollywood. You know, there was Carolco, there was Canon, there was MGM for a while. It doesn't make sense on the back of the envelope. You say, I don't really get this. They seem to be spending a lot. Ryan Kavanaugh is well known for flying around in his helicopter and parties and married to a supermodel, you know, and friends with Leo DiCaprio, all that kind of thing. You know, lots of high rolling, and it doesn't make sense. And then finally, one day, finally, after these things stay aloft much longer than you imagine possible, they go boom.
So is there a lot of schadenfreude happening right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's some yes and no. I mean, Hollywood needs people who want to buy movies. You know, they always want a buyer who has it, can write a check. So for that, they were like, hey, this guy was giving people a lot of work. So there's a little bit of boo-hoo about that. But there's always a chance that people are going to take the company over in bankruptcy who actually might run it in a more rational way and turn it into a thing. It's really hard to launch a film company at this point. It hasn't been done. DreamWorks tried to do it with, you know, the talents of David Geffen, Steven Spielberg, and Jeffrey Katzenberg. And it's diminished to virtually nothing at this, a very small thing at this point. So it's hard to do, but they may turn into a more reasonable version of a thing than it is now.
Well, is there a way that it could have made money if there wasn't so much high flying going on? In other words, if he had been a more prudent investor, could his formula have worked?
I think we can assume they would have lost less, but then they have lost, appear to be losing. But I don't think you would say they can make money. There's a new company, STX. They've just announced, we're going to do mid-range films. It's you know, they've raised a ton of money, again, from various sources, including the Chinese. And, you know, a lot of people have tried. Really, Lionsgate, which happened to hit Twilight and Hunger Games, is the only one that's been able to kind of get up on its legs. You know, the rest of them seem to not do very well, and a lot of people aren't really betting on this STX company, but we'll see.
So you have to be either really, really big or really, really small and indie to make it work.
You need, like, a library that throws off money when you're in the lean times. You need some giant hits to cover your costs when your other movies don't work. You know, that's why you see the studios swinging for the fences with Marvel movies and Batman movies and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because those big, when they come in and they're huge, they carry the whole thing along.
And with Ryan Kavanaugh, is anyone saying that there was any criminal misconduct here?
Well, he's just been called a con man in one of the lawsuits that's been filed against him. I think a lot of people might find that potentially a reasonable description. I mean, a lot of people have thought there is something wrong with this picture for a long time.
Although, you know, caveat emptor, a lot of investors want to throw money at Hollywood because it's sexy, and they know that it's not exactly a sure win.
You know, I am always in awe of people wanting to do this. You know, I wrote a book, Hit and Run, about, you know, these two guys that took Sony for lots and lots of money, and yet people still invested, you know, with one or the other. You really wonder, what does it take for people who are outsiders to say, this looks like a bad bet? You know, these guys are very slick at spinning their story, and I made this movie, I made that movie, and sometimes they did, maybe sometimes they kind of did, but I think people, you know, they want access to parties, they want to meet Leo DiCaprio, whatever, they're rich, you know, or I'm often like baffled by what motivates some of these people when they really put serious money, some of these institutions, into a thing like Relativity. It's been a mystery to me and others for quite some time now.
Okay, well, I guess the mystery is now unraveling for all.
Well,
to
and
see.
I will tell you, when it goes into court, into bankruptcy, if that happens, you're going to see a lot of laundry that will be aired publicly, and a reporter is looking forward to that.
Okay, well, you'll read it at The Hollywood Reporter, where Kim Masters is editor at large. And also host of The Business here on KCRW Mondays at 2:30. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, two men who turn their dislike of each other into must-watch television, the Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley debates during the 1968 political conventions.
Now, Bill, if I may say
I think ABC has the authority to invite.
Those debates reshaped political commentary after a news update with Jennifer Wolf.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. By the mid-1960s, the presidential conventions had turned into full-fledged TV events.
West Virginia passes.
They're at West Virginia in the roll call of states. Here's West Virginia.
I rise with a voice that has become hoarse in the exercise of democracy.
Reporters scurried around the convention floor with microphones and huge headsets. The anchors held court in perches high above the action. Sounds familiar? In 1968, ABC was dead last in the ratings. And so in order to spice up their convention coverage, ABC executives invited two towering intellectuals to a series of debates.
On the floor at this first day of the Republican convention, we've heard a few all-right speeches and quite a few ho-hum type speeches. We would like now to demonstrate how the English language ought to be used by two craftsmen, our guest commentators. William F. Buckley, Jr., a conservative Republican, columnist and commentator, and one-time candidate for mayor of New York. And Gore Vidal, author of, among other works, John Kennedy's favorite Broadway play, a play about a convention called The Best Man.
The fireworks between liberal Gore Vidal and conservative William F. Buckley, Jr. created giant ratings for ABC, and the spectacle ushered in the age of bellicose cable news commentary. Robert Gordon and Morgan Neville have directed a new documentary about those debates and their aftermath. It's called Best of Enemies. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with a bit of a primer. Morgan, who were these guys?
So, in many ways, Gore Vidal and William Buckley were two of the most visible public intellectuals in their respective political sides. William Buckley had started the National Review in the 1950s and since 1966 had started a weekly TV show called Firing Line that he then had for 33 years and was a noted conservative, intellectual writer and television figure. And Gore Vidal was a novelist and a satirist, a screenwriter, a playwright, and a fairly outrageous liberal thinker of his day. And in 1968, he just published his most successful book, Myra Breckinridge.
Which was about a transgender person.
Very ahead of its time. It was a man who became a woman who became a man.
Eventually starring Raquel Welch in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And kind of bears a passing resemblance to Caitlyn Jenner, I might add. But anyway. So these guys, before these debates happened in 1968, Robert, these guys did not like each other.
No, they'd written columns that opposed each other. They clashed on Parr. They clashed on David Susskind. In 1964, they clashed and Buckley told Vidal, I never want to see you again. And it was the only thing Buckley could say that Vidal would agree with.
And yet, Morgan, they were so similar, not only in the way they talked and the vocabulary that they used and their erudition, but also in their backgrounds.
Yeah, absolutely, which is part of what I think led to this deep animus between the two of them, because both of them debated people of the opposite political stripe all the time. Buckley did it weekly. But they never had this kind of deeply personal hatred, you know, and I say, this is not about frenemies. This is old school enemies. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no friendship whatsoever. They truly thought the other person was evil. And I think that wasn't just about the politics. It was about some aspect of that person being a distorted version of the mirror in the mirror of themselves.
Oh, interesting. And do you think that there was any sexual tension between them?
Yeah. After one of our screenings, somebody shouted out, just go ahead and get a bed.
Which would have appalled, I guess, Buckley.
Vidal was gay, though he would never identify as such. He hated labels. You know, he probably would have called himself a pansexualist. Buckley was married with a child, but Vidal, you know, because of his kind of effete demeanor, Vidal was constantly essentially gay baiting Buckley from the beginning, calling him the Marie Antoinette of the right wing, or
Mrs. Myra Breckinridge,
you know, on and on. I think Gore was really trying to play that card with Buckley.
And so they go at it at this convention. They start at the Republican convention
in Miami,
and then they move on to Chicago, which is its own story, right? With all the violence that happened there. But so they were given every night, they were given an opportunity to debate the day.
That was their assignment, to debate the issues of that day's convention. But they tended not to dwell there if they got there at all. It was really between them. They felt like the stakes were the nation, the future of the country, that if the other got his way, the republic would crumble. Mm. So each one just, it was verbal blood sport is what it was.
And by evidence of just what the plan of attack was from the beginning, one of those perfect little nuggets I found in the 5 years we made this documentary was going through Gore's papers, which are now at Harvard, and finding not only the thousands of pages of deposition from the years of lawsuits from them suing each other, but also the notes that Gore had in his lap during many of the debates, which had pages and pages of opposition research and pages of scripted insults ready to go.
Before you go any further, I would like to say that if there were a contest for Mr. Myra Breckinridge, you would unquestionably win it. I based her entire style polemically upon you, passionate and irrelevant.
That's too involuntary.
So those kind of tossed off remarks, seemingly tossed off, were not tossed off at all. They were pre-planned.
I think it was
a
combination of both.
Yeah.
I mean, Gore was an incredibly quick wit.
Yeah.
You know, I would not take that away from him, but you know, he came fully loaded.
Now, you mentioned lawsuits, Morgan, and those lawsuits stemmed from a comment that happened during this debate, right, where Gore Vidal calls Buckley a crypto-Nazi, and then...
And Buckley, in return, calls Gore a queer.
Yeah.
And then threatens to punch him.
The only crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that, I would only say that we can't have...
Now listen, you
the
queer,
right of assembly
stop calling me a crypto-Nazi.
Let's stop calling
I'll
names.
I'll
slap
you in your goddamn face, and you'll stay plastered.
Gentlemen, let's...
You can really see his fury on his
face. Oh, my God, yeah.
There's no pretending. This
rictus of loathing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but this isn't just pretending for the cameras. He was really out of control and full of, as you say, loathing at that moment.
And absolutely. And so it happened on television and then spilled over into the pages of Esquire magazine, where each Buckley and Vidal wrote lengthy essays under the guise of kind of an apology. But it's basically a character assassinations on each other. And they then sued each other and Esquire magazine over all kinds of things in those pieces. And it went on for years.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Robert Gordon and Morgan Neville about their new documentary. It's called Best of Enemies, about Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr. Now, how much of this was actually about the ideas of the day?
I think even their personal attacks were founded in the issues of the day. In other words, it was the culture wars. This was about lifestyle. So when they were attacking each other personally, they were attacking the ideas of the right and the ideas of the left. Now, as for specifics, there was 10 debates, 15 minutes each, 2.5 hours. Less than half of it actually was on the issues of the day.
And I think of it as, you know, they were really talking about the issues of the country. You know, they were less interested in 1968 than they were in the entire span of American history, because both of them had such a deep knowledge of American history and really believed that they understood what America was about. I mean, in a way, it's kind of Hamilton and Jefferson yet again playing itself out in this kind of distorted teleplay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you think that this could actually happen today, the same kind of debates? I mean, it's, even though, as you say, a lot of it was ad hominem attacks, they were very well-spoken, erudite ad hominem attacks.
Yes.
That level of intellectual discourse, it doesn't seem to exist today.
We don't create a place for it anymore, I don't think. I sort of think of it as the environment changed. You know,
even though these debates helped create that environment that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, because I think the takeaway was that the fireworks drew good ratings. And consequently, what's happened is we've cut to like 4 minutes of talk that you know that it's going to, they're going to come out banging each other. There's going to be fireworks, and then we can sell more soap, and then we'll come back and we'll do it all again. Everybody has talking points for, everybody's a shill, basically. These guys weren't a shill for either party. They had criticisms of the parties that they were, you know, so-called representing. They were bringing their own ideas to it, independent thought.
Of course, Buckley went on to exert an incredible influence over the Republican Party and the mm-hmm. conservative movement and influenced Ronald Reagan, for example.
Absolutely.
Gore Vidal did not have a similar level of influence on the left. Why not?
I kind of think that in the immediate years, in the years immediately after 68, that was Buckley's time. The apogee of his work was the election of Ronald Reagan. But now, almost 50 years later, we are living Vidal's predictions. He was an early promoter of gay rights.
Right.
Legalization of marijuana.
Yeah, exactly. All the issues that he was doing in these commentaries, we're living them now.
I mean, I think that the difference is that, you know, Buckley realized early on, he started as an insurgent in the right. Vidal was never really interested in running an organization or a party or joining anything. He was not a joiner. I think he had a kind of a distance to his intellectual thought and a physical distance in that he spent most of the last 50 years of his life living in Italy. And
or as he said, I divide my time between Italy and Los Angeles, which is to say I hardly live in the United States at all.
But he ran for office twice.
He did. The first time, I think, was the last moment he thought he might be a real player inside the American political system.
You know, 1960.
Yeah, 1960. He ran for a congressional seat in upstate New York. He was on the Kennedy ticket. He was related through marriage to Jackie Onassis and knew Jack quite well and spent time at the White House. But through a number of convoluted circumstances and a falling out with Bobby Kennedy, was kind of banished from the White House and in the wake of that left America. And I think that was the last time he really thought about any kind of political career seriously. He came back and ran for Senate in California in 1982 for a third party position. And that was really more to make an intellectual point. But I don't think he gave politics any real serious thought after that.
You know, it's always you're making these films and you learn a lot. And one of the things I never had any idea of that we learned in the course of doing the interviews was that Vidal had thought of himself as presidential material, which is so shocking to me to think of still, but that I knew that his grandfather had been one of the first senators from Oklahoma. His father had served in the Roosevelt administration, and he sort of saw himself as an heir apparent to the nation.
That's, yeah, it's a bit shocking to think.
Yeah,
but
as
maybe
somebody says in the film, Gore certainly didn't have the common touch. And that is a serious understatement.
Well, neither one of them did, right? I mean, both of them have these kind of faux patrician accents, and they don't seem of America in the way that we normally associate.
Absolutely. As somebody had said, not in nature found.
Yeah,
that's where their accents completely unique. Yet, there was something about them that people could relate to, or maybe not even relate to, but were compelled by, in part because I think both Vidal and Buckley understood theater in a major, mm-hmm. major way. I mean, I really think Buckley's first love was not politics, but debate. And Vidal, of course, was a screenwriter and playwright and loved theater. And I think both of them understood what television was, that it was theater in a way that no other Republican intellectuals of their era did.
So after those debates and after the crypto-Nazi fiasco, did they ever speak again?
Never.
No.
That was it.
Never.
They carried it with them. Now then, and so then they would be asked about it all the time. Buckley was desperate to put this behind him. And whenever he was asked, goaded into trying to say something about Vidal, he always demurred. Vidal never missed an opportunity to lob more rotten eggs at Buckley. I left his bloody corpse on the floor of the Chicago Amphitheater.
Interesting. There's a great clip at the end of your movie where someone plays that mm-hmm. clip to him. He's very old.
Mm-hmm.
And they find the footage, the crypto-Nazi footage, and he just looks aghast.
Yeah. I think he was. I mean, that footage is in black and white. It's the only footage that ABC doesn't have that actually comes from a source in Nashville, a news archive. And Buckley's biographer was in the audience that day, and Buckley goes up to him during the commercial break, not after the show, and says to him, "I thought that tape had been destroyed." And it's a conspiracy theory that we have. So there's nothing factual about what I'm about to say. It's just a thought. But ABC has multiple versions in color of all the nights of the full broadcasts of the conventions. The only one they don't have is that one. And it's possible that Bill had the reach somehow to send someone in those in the ABC archives, have those tapes destroyed, which would explain why he was so surprised to see this footage still existing.
Wow.
Yeah.
But what was it about it that upset him so much?
I mean, Bill was the king of cool. Yeah. I mean, he had a TV show on and he was always in control. I mean, that was his whole persona. That was central to his persona. And, you know, we spent so much time going back and watching old firing lines, which are fantastic to watch. And whether it was Muhammad Ali or Jack Kerouac or Allen Ginsberg or Noam Chomsky or all the people, Norman Mailer, who went on the show many times, Bill never looked flustered at all. And this was the one moment in his life where he lost it. And he lost it in a very, very public way. And I think it was really shameful for him.
Well, given the fact that they ushered in the modern, as I said, bellicose world of debating on cable news and elsewhere, do you think these two guys could get jobs today doing that?
Not really.
Yeah.
No, I mean, even look at them at the end of their lives. You know, Buckley's show was taken off the air. You rarely saw him anymore on television. And Vidal would occasionally appear on C-SPAN and places like that at the end of his life. But these were two people who were central to American culture in the 1960s, and by the end of their lives didn't fit into the TV landscape anymore. I mean, frankly, some of Buckley's sentences would take 60 seconds.
Yeah.
You just can't do that on commercial TV these days.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Madeline.
This is such a civil discussion. I feel like we should be
now we can get uncivil.
Step outside.
Fighting or something. Robert Gordon, Morgan Neville, directors of Best of Enemies. It comes out this Friday. Another civil discussion coming up at 1 o'clock, I hope.
Fortunately, we are the best of friends. Yes, we will have a civil discussion. But it's a very interesting subject and very controversial. It's about the Highway Trust Fund. For the 34th time, Congress is now going to have a short-term fix. This one's 3 months long. When everybody knows that the transportation infrastructure is falling apart, we are falling behind other countries. The leadership that we had in the aftermath of World War II is kaput, just gone. The bullet train in Japan is 50 years old, and we don't have one yet. Got a lot of freeway overpasses, though.
Right. Well, I'm going to tell you this, Warren. We're not going to have to worry about that because we'll all be wiped out by killer robots. That's what we're going to talk about next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It may be old news here in Hollywood, but the world's scientists are now warning us about killer robots. Hundreds of scientists, including Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk, wrote an open letter released this week in which they warned of a global AI arms race. And the letter recommends, quote, a ban on offensive autonomous weapons beyond meaningful human control. One of the signatories to that letter is Peter Asaro. He's assistant professor at the New School in New York and vice chair of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I have to say, reading about this letter was really scary. It says that the possibility of robots capable of killing on their own is feasible within years, not decades. What does that mean?
Well, I think what that means is we already have the technology to attach sensors to weapons guns, missiles, and have those computers automatically determine when to fire those weapons. And you can do that now in a very primitive way. But what we're really seeing is a massive investment by major military and arms contractors to develop the next generation of weapons that will do this in a very sophisticated way. And this includes a fully autonomous drone aircraft that wouldn't be remotely piloted or have humans doing the targeting, but would be able to do targeting and firing decisions completely autonomously based on visual processing algorithms and artificial intelligence software.
So how would they know exactly when to attack?
Well, there would be various ways to try to build that. And of course, one of the big problems with this technology is that all of this development would be highly top secret and classified. And so we wouldn't really be able to understand from the outside or as civilians how these systems work or what basis they're using to make targeting decisions. But you could do something, you know, along the Hollywood lines of the Terminator of trying to identify a particular individual like Sarah Connor based on a photograph and visual recognition. You could do something more in terms of patterns of behavior. So if somebody was acting aggressively or appeared to be pointing a weapon at you or at the robot, then the robot could react to that. And those are, you know, very complicated kinds of algorithms, which, you know, right now would not work with any kind of accuracy or would be very dangerous to try to deploy. But this kind of technology, of course, is developing very rapidly, and it's not clear at what point these systems will be attempted to be used by different militaries.
But it sounds like from the tone of the letter that this is not in the realm of science fiction or in the realm of some, you know, fantasy many, many years away, that this could happen relatively quickly in a bad way and not just be something theoretical.
Yeah, I mean, these systems are in development. The X-47B is a Navy autonomous drone that the U.S. is developing. The Taranis is a British autonomous drone. And, you know, their websites and videos say they have some capacity to, you know, engage targets independently of human control. We don't know exactly what that means. There's also a missile system that the UK is using called Brimstone, and another one that the US is developing called the LARASM, Long Range Anti-Ship Missile, which again have some kind of autonomous targeting function that uses an artificial intelligence, the details of which are obscure.
Why are these powers developing these weapons? What do they want to use them for?
Well, I think there's a motivation to try to protect your own troops, keeping them out of harm's way. And, of course, the increased efficiency of automation. I think that's what drives automation, and artificial intelligence is a form of automation. Trying to reduce the costs and the number of personnel you need to train in order to deploy the military. Of course, in the long run, that also means you have fewer humans involved in war, involved in making decisions, and less of a, you know, civil engagement with the kinds of wars that the nation engages in.
Well, I guess people could argue that that's what's happening with drones now, and that even being used by humans, there are grievous mistakes.
Right, and many of those we hear about because there are humans there. There are humans who suffer the post-traumatic stress of what it is to be an operator in those situations. And while that's a bad situation for those operators, if we fully automated that, it doesn't mean those situations would disappear. It just means it would be computers doing it, and we would never hear about it in the press or in the public forum.
And so is there any kind of international discussion happening aside from your open letter about limiting this kind of weaponry?
Yeah, there's been a campaign to stop killer robots. That's a coalition of non-governmental organizations that's been working for the past few years at the United Nations level to get international discussions moving. The Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which is a treaty body of the United Nations, has been holding expert meetings for the past 2 years on these sorts of weapons and what should be done. And at this level, it's still, you know, consultory and advisory, but we're hoping at the upcoming meeting of the CCW in November that they actually vote to move towards a more formal process that could lead towards a treaty negotiation.
And which countries are developing these weapons?
The ones that we know about, of course, are the advanced militaries, the United States, Russia, China, Israel, South Africa, Australia, these Korea, South Korea. these countries have the technical means and have already sort of announced that they're developing different kinds of weapons in this arena. Other countries could be doing it as well. And if it follows the pattern of drones, which seems very likely, it went from a handful or one country that had the technology to 70 countries with the technology in just a handful of years.
So Stephen Hawking, in his part of it, or he has said this in the past, that this really could be humanity's last act, that this is humanity's biggest existential threat. Would you go that far?
I think nuclear weapons and climate change might rival it for sure, but I think it is a very serious risk. I think it's a risk to civilians who might get caught in the crossfire. I think it's a risk to humanity in the sense that we give over control over the use of violence and the control of warfare itself to automated processes that we may not understand or be able to fully control.
But given the fact that you say all these countries are working on it, half a dozen or more countries and countries with a lot of money, are you optimistic you can dial it back and get a ban on these weapons?
I think so, and I think the key is to really have it be this preemptive ban before any of these countries are really dependent on these systems for their military forces to ban them and to get a comprehensive ban that covers all of these countries. So if any one country develops the technology, then other countries will feel the need to defend themselves by developing similar technologies, and you very quickly wind up in an arms race situation, and that could be regional or global in nature. So I think it is possible, and I think we've seen this with other weapons in the past, especially with chemical weapons and biological weapons, where there were some people who were optimistic that it could be, a new and more humane form of warfare. And when it didn't turn out that way, they had to do a lot of work to roll back and create a prohibition on that. With blinding lasers, we were actually successful in getting a preemptive ban. It was clear that the technology was imminent and it was going to be used, and the CCW in the 1990s was able to create a preemptive ban that was quite successful. And, the technology to make blinding lasers is available, but we don't see any major military contractors or arms manufacturers building and designing permanently blinding lasers.
But is there also a worry that if you do enact a ban on this, or if that ban is successful, that there might be some hampering effect on legitimate AI research?
Well, I think that's precisely why this letter is coming from the scientists and engineers at this point, because they see that the potential benefits of AI technology and robotics is enormous, and they want to continue doing that research. But they also recognize that those technologies can be put to very bad uses. And absent any kind of international regulatory framework, like a treaty that would prohibit these weapons, there's no assurances that the technology won't be used that way. And I think what they're calling for is those assurances that it won't be used that way, so they can actually proceed with developing the technology in ways that could benefit humanity greatly.
And what about this technology falling into the wrong hands, like an AQ-Con?
Yeah, well, I think, if we allow the military development of this technology, then the proliferation will be incredibly rapid, the way it was with drones. It's not like atomic weapons, where you really need a massive industrial base and a lot of rare materials and sophisticated technology to create a nuclear bomb. With autonomous weapons, you can buy many of the components off the shelf right now from a hobby store and put together a very crude system. Once these sophisticated military systems are available in the world market, you're going to see a rapid proliferation to many states, to tyrants and dictators who want to oppress their own people, and of course to non-state actors and terrorists.
Okay, so I'm now sharing your urgency. It sounds very serious. Peter Osaro, assistant professor at the New School in New York and vice chair of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Julie Myers.
Oh, hey, no big deal. The robots are coming for us.
Why bother?
Why bother with the Olympic bid at all? But we did put that question to our listeners. Olympics in LA, yes or no? And they were pretty much divided down the middle. Philip Fuller on Facebook says that the Olympics seems like an absurd thing to spend money on, especially for a city that's fiscal health depends on gouging residents with parking tickets. No, 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 no. And Julie tweets, traffic nightmare much? But Lori Hazenkamp recalls that in 1984, the traffic was not horrible at all. The city made certain thoroughfares into one-way express streets, and a lot of Angelenos got out of town for vacations, workplaces, staggered employee hours. If only we could keep those policies post-Olympics.
All right. If you have thoughts on this, we'd love to hear from you. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers, thank you for that. And Warren Olney is up next at 1 o'clock with To The Point. So keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.